Chapter 11. Early Thought. First, primitive philosophy. Second, the old man in religion. Third, fear and hope in religion. Fourth, stars and seasons. Fifth, storytelling and myth-making. Sixth, complex origins of religion. First, before we go on to tell how 6,000 or 7,000 years ago men began to gather into the first towns and to develop something more than the loose-knit tribes that had hitherto been their highest political association, something must be said about the things that were going on inside these brains, of which we have traced the growth and development through a period of 500,000 years from the ape-man stage. What was man thinking about himself and about the world in those remote days? At first he thought very little about anything but immediate things. At first he was busy thinking such things as, here's a bear, what shall I do? Or there's a squirrel, how can I get it? Until language had developed to some extent, there could have been very little thinking beyond the range of actual experience. For language is the instrument of thought, as bookkeeping is the instrument of business. It records and fixes and enables thought to get on to more and more complex ideas. It's the hand of the mind to hold and keep. Primordial man, before he could talk, probably saw very vividly, mimicked very cleverly, gestured, laughed, danced, and lived, without much speculation about whence he came or why he lived. He feared the dark, no doubt, and thunderstorms, and big animals, and queer things, and whatever he dreamt about, and no doubt he did things to propitiate what he feared, or to change his luck and please the imaginary powers in rock and beast and river. He made no clear distinction between animate and inanimate things. If a stick hurt him, he kicked it. If the river foamed and flooded, he thought it was hostile. His thought was probably very much at the level of a bright little contemporary boy of 4 or 5. He had the same subtle unreasonableness of transition and the same limitations. But since he had little or no speech, he would do little to pass on the fancies that came to him and develop any tradition or concerted acts about them. The drawings, even of late Paleolithic man, don't suggest that he paid any attention to sun or moon or stars or trees. He was preoccupied only with animals and men. Probably he took day and night, sun and stars, trees and mountains, as being in the nature of things, as a child takes its meal times and its nursery staircase for granted. So far as we can judge, he drew no fantasies, no ghosts, or anything of that sort. The reindeer men's drawings are fearless, familiar things, with no hint about them of any religious or occult feelings. There's scarcely anything that we can suppose to be a religious or mystical symbol at all in his productions. No doubt he had a certain amount of what's called fetishism in his life. He did things we should now think unreasonable to produce desired ends, for that's all fetishism amounts to. It's only incorrect science based on guesswork or false analogy, and entirely different in its nature from religion. No doubt he was excited by his dreams, and his dreams mixed up at times in his mind with his waking impressions, and puzzled him. Since he buried his dead, and since even the later Neanderthal men seem to have buried their dead, and apparently with food and weapons, it's been argued that he had a belief in a future life. But it's just as reasonable to suppose that early men buried their dead with food and weapons because they doubted if they were dead, which is not the same thing as believing them to have immortal spirits, and that their belief in their continuing vitality was reinforced by dreams of the departed. They may have ascribed a sort of werewolf existence to the dead and wished to propitiate them. The reindeer man, we feel, was too intelligent and too like ourselves not to have had some speech, but quite probably it wasn't very serviceable for anything beyond direct statement or matter-of-fact narrative. He lived in a larger community than the Neanderthaler, but how large we don't know. Except when game is swarming, hunting communities mustn't keep together in large bodies or they'll starve. The Indians who depend upon the caribou in Labrador must be living under circumstances rather like those of the reindeer men. They scatter in small family groups, as the caribou scatter, in search of food. that when the deer collect for the seasonal migration, the Indians also collect. That's the time for trade and feasts and marriages. The simplest American Indian is 10,000 years more sophisticated than the reindeer man, but probably that sort of gathering and dispersal was also the way of reindeer men. At Selloutrey, in France, there are traces of a great camping and feasting place. There's no doubt an exchange of news there, but one may doubt if there was anything like an exchange of ideas. One sees no scope in such a life for theology or philosophy or superstition or speculation. Fears, yes, but unsystematic fears, fancies and freaks of the imagination, but personal and transitory freaks and fancies. Perhaps there was a certain power of suggestion in these encounters. A fear really felt needs few words for its transmission. A value set upon something may be very simply conveyed. In these questions of primitive thought and religion, we must remember that the lowly and savage peoples of today probably throw very little light on the mental state of men before the days of fully developed language. Primordial man could have had little or no tradition before the development of speech. All savage and primitive peoples of today, on the contrary, are soaked in tradition, the tradition of thousands of generations. They may have weapons like their remote ancestors and methods like them, but what were slight and shallow impressions on the minds of their predecessors are now deep and intricate grooves worn throughout the intervening centuries, generation by generation. Second, certain very fundamental things there may have been in men's minds long before the coming of speech. Chief among these must have been fear of the old man of the tribe. The young of the primitive squatting place grew up under that fear. Objects associated with him were probably forbidden. Everyone was forbidden to touch his spear or to sit in his place, just as today little boys mustn't touch father's pipe or sit in his chair. He was probably the master of all the women. The youths of the little community had to remember that. The idea of something forbidden, the idea of things being, as it's called, taboo, not to be touched, not to be looked at, may thus have got well into the human mind at a very early stage indeed. J.J. Atkinson, in his Primal Law, an ingenious analysis of these primitive taboos, which are found among savage people all over the world, the taboos that separate brother and sister, the taboos that make a man run and hide from his stepmother, traces them to such a fundamental cause as this. Only by respecting this primal law could the young male hope to escape the old man's wrath. And the old man must have been an actor in many a primordial nightmare. A disposition to propitiate him, even after he was dead, is quite understandable. One wasn't sure that he was dead. He might only be asleep or shamming. Long after an old man was dead, when there was nothing to represent him but a mound and a megalith, the women would convey to their children how awful and wonderful he was. And being still a terror to his own little tribe, it was easy to go on to hoping that he would be a terror to other and hostile people. In his life, he had fought for his tribe, even if he'd bullied it. Why not when he was dead? One sees that the old man idea was an idea very natural to the primitive mind and capable of great development. And opposed to the old man, more human and kindlier, was the mother, who helped and sheltered and advised. The psychoanalysis of Freud and Jung has done much to help us to realize how great a part father fear and mother love still play in the adaptation of the human mind to social needs. They've made an exhaustive study of childish and youthful dreams and imaginations, a study which has done much to help in the imaginative reconstruction of the soul of primitive man.